outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gym.
Well, Kyle, it was 30 years ago this month that my life changed drastically.
30 years ago, okay.
30 years ago is when I got my walk-in papers from the congregation I had helped to plant. And actually, I'd never got any papers. I was just, the congregation was told, actually, that I had resigned and was leaving even while I was out of town doing something else. So, man, my whole life changed on that moment. Something really horribly done to us. But the obedience to not take my place back and to find out what else God had to teach, that choice in that circumstance has yielded all the fruit of the last 30 years. And man, so I every December I think about it, because what a cruel time. If you're going to knife someone in the back, it often happens in December. And I think it's because people are trying to clear the decks for January or whatever. They want to start fresh. But man, I've heard so many betrayal stories that happened in December. But to think that was 30 years ago now, man.
Do you ever wonder what would have happened if you would have stayed and fought? If you ever reflect on that?
Sure. And I think I might still be there trying to get this thing to work.
Really? You think so?
I don't know. We spent 15 years trying to get it to work before, and I wasn't done yet until I found myself outside of it. If I was still trying to make, and I don't mean that thing, I mean any institutional box work for the presence of God,
yeah,
I would have considered my life very futile. That's not saying you can be in that kind of situation and not trying to get the box to do that, and you're out doing it just in your own life, making God's presence known. I admire people that can do that, and I know people who do that well.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it was, there's something we can just get right. We're going to keep tweaking, poking, changing. Because I was a systems guy back in the day, and it may have taken that kind of liberation from a system, which, as we've told many times, that's a dark 2 years after that. The 2 years after this December are not, oh, we're free, let's go, have a great time. It was, oh my gosh, we were just shredded on the inside. Everything we'd put our trust in was gone except for God. And we hadn't put a lot of our trust in God, as we discovered. But man, everything that's gone on in my life proceeded from that moment. Yeah, I reflect on that about every Christmas, but thinking, man, 30 years ago, that's a long time.
That's wild. That had to have been like the weirdest homecoming ever, to walk back into that congregation not knowing that you had been resigned.
No, I knew. I knew before.
Oh, you did?
No. Yeah. They.
Oh, okay.
I was leaving to go out of town, and they gave me a piece of paper about a letter they were going to read, a 4-page letter that announced my resignation. And I begged myself, I want you to not do this. I'll come back next week. I'll be here. We can. Nope. We're going to read it. We're going to do it. We're going to do it. And I thought, well, I'll come back and clean up that mess. But yeah, it would have been weird walking back in, but every time I tried, the phrase kept running through my mind, I have more to teach you if you walk away. Now, you can go back in there and fight if you want. You can go back in there and even have your stomp the dust off my foot kind of moment. You know, but I look back now going, I could not have made a better decision, and God could not have been more faithful to me and Sarah. And even though it was scary and horrifying and depressing. He found a way through that darkness for us. And now we've lived the life that we could only have dreamed about before.
Yeah, man, there's just something about the holiday season for some reason that as we were initially talking about, as before we were prepping for the podcast today, I just mentioned that we are 2 days out from when the doctors think that my daughter's appendix ruptured this time last year, and the harrowing things that went on around that and her almost dying, and then the subsequent mental health stuff that our family had to navigate after that. And I mean, it could have happened any time of the year, but for some reason, I mean, when I was practicing in mental health as therapists, it was a generally accepted norm that you started building in and planning on extra time that you were going to be with your clients. It was almost like a retail store that's like getting ready for the big sales and stuff, but it was the therapist getting ready for crisis. Because basically starting the middle of November to the new year, it was just complete chaos for clients.
A lot of challenges there, isn't there? You got the whole family dynamics of Thanksgiving, and then you've got the whole gift buying. What are we going to do for everybody that goes on December? Then you've got the family stuff in December. Then you've got a new year coming at you. And what's that going to be like? And what does God want to show me about the new year?
Yeah.
It puts a lot of pressure on people's lives, this kind of season.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
Yeah. Well, let's, I'm avoiding that. Me and Sarah are just going to get through the season, enjoy our family, and get on to the new year. And not much is changing other than negotiating. I like the pace we're on now, one day at a time. So we're just pacing through today. What does today mean? Tomorrow, what does tomorrow mean? We're not looking too far down the road because I don't even know, like even share with your daughter, your whole life can turn on a dime. And you don't know what's coming.
Yes.
And I'm kind of that way with the roller coaster ride of the chemo. There are days I feel like old Wayne, man. I can sit here and get some stuff done and do stuff with Sarah and just feels normal. And there's other days where I could hardly get a thought in my head and keep it. So, it's just one day at a time. Today I have it. So let's make the most of today. And tomorrow, if I don't have it, now I make the most of getting some rest in. So,
do you find that more challenging or a little bit easier at this stage of your life and being present in a day-to-day versus planning or trying to have some presumption of where you're going to be going in the day? Because ever since I've known you, you've kind of been a planner. You've had a few things, multiple fire or irons in the fire kind of all the time, projects, different things that you were doing or exploring. Now, the longer I've known you, the less structured those plans have been and the shorter the time period that those plans have been. What is that like for you? I mean, especially in this season as you and Sarah are navigating this.
Well, we feel like we've been living this way for a while.
Okay.
You know, just in life in general. So that this back issue and cancer issue, you create some new challenges. It's like, okay, we know this land well. We know how to wake up today and go, what can we do? What can we not do? And so it doesn't feel awkward at all. It just feels fine. And I've got, you know, I got a new project thrown at me from, I thank God, recently. So now it's like, okay, it's not less to do. There's more to do, but I'm still an inspiration kind of writer. When I sit down in the morning, it's what do I feel inspired to write? Not I've got to finish this project. So I got to do the next piece of this or the next piece of that. I don't. So where am I inspired? So having four files open in front of me going, I want to go over here and go in there. And which means I may never get any of them done. I don't know. That's going to depend on the life God gives me and its longevity. I think maybe, what was that? There was a fairy tale about trying to spin something forever and you couldn't die till they spinning some kind of wool or some kind of fairy tale or something about, they'd unwind it at night and start again the next day. So they wouldn't, whatever. I think I'm doing that with God. Just so you want me to finish these, you have to keep me alive. I would do three words a day. No, not quite that bad. Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
Let me throw some email at you quickly. John wrote this, and I thought this is kind of fun. He said, the last sentence you used on this week's podcast last week struck a note for me. He quoted it. He's doing a work in me and not me doing it for him. I think those throwaway lines at the end often get lost. I'd love the callback on that. It's not us for him. It's him for us. And if that's the life we live, then daily becomes possible because there's enough grace for today. Not enough grace for tomorrow. And this from JKB on the blog. He wrote, Wayne and Sarah, when I listened to you both, this is a podcast two times ago, I am so thankful for your example of sharing. You are both seasoned believers. I decided not to take offense at that term, but you are both seasoned believers, and I'm learning much. As you said at the end, this world is broken. So much pain everywhere, but God will see us through the valley of the shadow of death. Please keep on sharing the details of this difficult journey as you are able. My prayers are for your perseverance and healing. Sarah and I wonder at times, as we've gone through her trauma and now dealing with some of my medical issues, are we sharing too much? Are we, you know, it seems somewhat indulgent to take a podcast and talk about processing our journey. We do it because we feel like it will help people who have similar things in their journey. And it's more helpful to hear it in real time and not hear it after we've sanitized the story and everything's well and dandy and all that again. And to get a letter like that, just, and I've gotten a number like that. I read this one because it was kind of well said, but I get a number of people saying, it is so grateful to hear two people navigating the darkness in your lives right now and hear how you talk to God, how you relate to him, how you think of it, how you walk. And to that end, I'm really blessed because that's the reason we would share it. We certainly wouldn't share it because I can't wait to have it on the front page of the podcast.
I feel like our culture does not do vulnerability well. You know, I mean, Brené Brown has made a name for herself internationally.
Yep.
By the power of vulnerability. I mean, starting out there and talking about shame versus openness, authenticity, vulnerability, and community. And I think you and Sarah are pretty rare in regards to the level of openness, transparency, honesty that you're willing to allow people in, because that's not easy to do. That is not an easy skill set to develop.
Maybe not, but from my standpoint, it's easier than trying to pretend not, or it's easier than talking around it.
Okay.
That's why I sent you an article somebody sent me this week. It was called The Wound is the Gift, mm-hmm. David White on the relationship between anxiety and intimacy. And the title caught my eye. A good friend sent that to me, Joni out of Oklahoma. And she didn't say much about it. I said, so why'd you send this to me? You know, what were you thinking when you read it? She still has not responded to that text. So Joni, that's why I send you texts. So you actually write back and tell me what you're thinking about it. But anyway, I thought I'd pass it on to you because I would think this is one of those things where you and I would come at it from very different perspectives. Yeah. I don't find any anxiety in intimacy at all. I mean, the first book I wrote in 1987, The Naked Church, was the loss of intimacy in the church between God and his people. And we had substituted programs and platforms, and we've only done more and more of that in the, I don't know, 50 years since I wrote that book, or 40 years or whatever 87 is. I guess it's only about 37 years. We find people saying that all the time, whether it was us sharing the story of Sarah's trauma or us sharing some of the medical, God, you guys have such courage, such bravery to share those things. And Sarah and I look at each other like, doesn't seem brave. It just seems like we're talking about what's going on in our lives. Where are we getting it wrong?
I don't think it's a question of getting it wrong. I do have to say that your ability to keep or maintain an open and vulnerable, open and welcoming heart, given the things that you have navigated in your life, still baffles me. Like,
how so?
After like 13 years of friendship, it still baffles me.
How so? What baffles you?
Well, the rarity of someone who, to be bluntly honest, it doesn't make sense in my head. Like, I've tried to make sense of your ability to say that genuinely and honestly over the last 13 years, and I still haven't figured it out. Because when we talk about relationship, we're talking, I would say, about one of the deepest tensions in the human heart. Because you're talking about our greatest desire, which I think is to be truly known,
okay,
by other, truly known and loved by someone else or other people. And it's also our deepest fear, because if we are known and then we're seen, like we allow somebody to see us, we allow somebody in, we allow somebody to view us, and then the feedback that we get is, ooh, I don't like that, or I reject that, or, oh, you need to really change this about yourself because I don't even know if I want to be around you until you do. You know, if that's the type of feedback you get when you expose the deepest, most intimate parts of your heart, if that's the feedback that you get, it can be devastating to people. It can be completely upending for that person's life, especially if that is a person, unfortunately, often it comes from people that were designed by God to be the initial authors of our experience of unconditional love. Because often it's our parents or our close family system that we expose ourselves to, we're vulnerable to, we open up our heart to, and the feedback that we get is, yeah, you're loved, but, or yeah, you're loved if. And there's these caveats of whether or not we're accepted, whether or not we even are operating on a foundation of love and acceptance. That is so destabilizing for people in some really, really hard ways that that follow people for their entirety of their lives.
Well, there was one of the quotes in the article is from Ralph Waldo Emerson, and it quotes from his journal, said, "There is no terror like that of being known."
Yeah.
And when I read the quote, I went, I don't get it. I have more I have more terror if I'm unknown. I have more, you know what, because I really detest this in a relationship where you spend time with somebody, and you consider honest, open sharing time, and then find out later that they were being disingenuous with you. They were nodding and, you know, seemingly companioning with what you were sharing. Then you find out later they went and told somebody what an idiot I was later. I've had that happen, and I hate it. Mm-hmm. I would rather you be genuine with me, even if that's not fun, even if it's, you know, I think you're a bit of a jerk or, you know, whatever you've got to say, rather than you go say it to someone else later and I go on in the ignorance of thinking we were on a similar page when you were judging me and taking it somewhere else and then using it as against me. And I guess I've had that happen so often, because I've had that happen a lot. But I've had more opportunities where people come back with, man, what you shared really helped me. Or I really like this email about you and Sarah being honest in your struggles is really teaching me a lot, because you guys have had some experience on this journey of living in grace and living in the reality of, I can only be genuine from my own life. The response I get back from other people is on them.
Yeah.
If the response is genuinely kind and gracious and companioning, and I have that in spades all over the world. I have so many people, whether it's what I went through with Sarah, whether it's what I'm going through now with the cancer and the back issue, I have so many people who are in that with me. And I mean genuinely in that. They're kind, they're gracious. They don't always have to agree with me, because I don't require that of friendships. I would rather have honesty than agreement. And I have that in spades. So where I don't have it, doesn't bother me. It just doesn't land anywhere.
The one conclusion that I've come to in regards to
trying to analyze my life. Are you going to do the biography on me when I'm gone, Kyle, and muse on these things?
Maybe if you want me to, I would definitely do
that. Hey, I'm gone. I can people do whatever they want. I've got one guy who wants to write my biography already, and he's really? All set to do it. And I'm like, I'm not sure he's the right person to do it just because of our relationship, the nature of it, but maybe. I'd rather have that than write my own, and then you only get one-sided opinion of it. But even if you were to write my biography, would you still be wrestling with this? How did he do that?
Probably, yeah. Wow. Depends on how long you're alive and how long our friendship's going on this earth.
And we have more work to do, Padawan.
No, I think one of the conclusions that I've come to is that the longer that you live in the understanding of authentic love, the more you're able to have a freedom to be yourself and authentic and wholehearted in other relationships, and not have wherever that relationship goes be the final say on how vulnerable or how authentically you show up. And that's, you know, when I think about it, the more I've been able to live openly and allow my life to be lived openly around others and share authentically with others, that's come from a deeper understanding of Father's love. When he became that primary source of identity and affirmation, and the longer I've lived in that, the longer I've seen him thrive in that, the more my community has become rich and saturated with similar experiences of love and trust and affection, it gives that settledness. It gives that rest in myself where, like you said, I'd rather them be genuine and honest. And they like, whether they receive me or not, that's on them. I need to show up as who I am. I want to show up authentically. I want to show up in a loving and caring way. And if they have a different opinion of me, then I mean, that's not on me. And I've seen you live that a lot. It just.
And you have to genuinely live that too, because if you take it as your mission that I've got to convince them that they're wrong, you will exhaust yourself.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And confront them, you know, I know you went and talked to so-and-so and now I'm going to come and talk to you. If you're going to play that game, that little gossip game, play the gossip game. I'm not going to play it. And yes, am I going to lose in certain arenas because I'm not playing the gossip game? Yes, I did. I lost in my extended family that way because I wouldn't play the gossip game. So I know what that is. Yeah. But to me, to live authentically, not only is the greatest freedom internally, one of the things this article said is intimacy is the art and practice of living from the inside out. And when I read that statement, I love that statement. It's the authenticity of living from the inside, letting it come out. If people don't respond well to that, because I find most people do respond well to it. Most people really do want to know the authentic you, and even if they're not. And I realize that's why I try not to get in the details on the cancer and chemo and all that, because I realize there's a TMI thing where you just too much info. I don't need that. But what they're talking about in this one, the terrors that Emerson talks about, there's no terror like being known. He said, for it knows that there is no greater pain than the pain of intimacy severed by betrayal, by distance, or by death.
Yeah.
And I read that line and went, wow, there's no pain greater. There's no joy greater than being known, period. If correct. The cost is sometimes betrayal, sometimes always death, at least in this age, always at distance. There's relationships are an ever-changing reality. Who I was close to 20 years ago is not the same as who I'm close to today, though some of the relationships I had 20 years ago, I still have. They're still meaningful in my life. But new ones come in all the time. Sarah and I moved on the street a year and a half ago. And our community getting through this cancer is our neighborhood, our neighbors. If we're walking down the street, some of them come out and talk to us about, hey, how you doing? How's the back going? You know, what's chemo like? And I mean, they've offered to bring trash cans in for Sarah because I can't bring them in. And sometimes they just do it without asking. They're just in our backyard later. We've experienced community with people only known for a year and a half because we've just not tried to hide anything from people. Now, some people we notice, we're not idiots. We notice, we can't really do it on a podcast because you're not seeing people, but we know when sharing is getting beyond someone's capacity to handle it. There's just more detail, more vulnerability than they're comfortable with. And I'm never for dragging person down that line. I'll never be less than authentic, but that doesn't mean I'll be completely, you need to know everything I want you to know. Because you kind of qualify for that. When you're ready for it, you can have some of that. But I don't even, like we were in the apartment complex for not quite a year where Sarah was. Oh gosh, I was only there 5 months, but maybe a little longer. But we made friends in the complex. We knew we'd be leaving them. We knew we'd never see them again. But for the moments we were there, we could have conversations and explore things and have dinner with people. And I'm comfortable with that being an ever. So distance doesn't scare me. Death doesn't scare me because to me, the person who's getting out by death, who knows God, they've just gained everything. Okay, I'm the loser in that relationship because I miss them. And there's people, when I went through the thing with Sarah, there's Dave Coleman. There's people I wish I could have called and talked to who are no longer here. And Kevin Smith from Australia and others. But I had some other living souls who were around that could do that for us. So I don't really fear any of those things. Betrayal, I've learned, I think, not to connect your wagon to someone else's wagon. You know, let the wagons be side by side, but not linked, because most people will do what's in their economic self-interest, regardless of whatever they told you they would do. So I don't. And that's, to me, that's Jesus in John 2, where he says he entrusted himself to no man because he knew it was in all men. So he didn't live connected trust-wise with people. Like, I probably wouldn't go into business with somebody and share bank accounts, and I wouldn't do any of that stuff with another human being on the planet, because the times I have been filled with dishonesty and betrayal, because people are willing to take advantage of anything they can get their hands on.
Yeah.
And their friends and advisors will encourage them to do that as well. So, but that doesn't, I fear more that, to me, the terror is I wouldn't be known, that people wouldn't know the real me or care about the real me. And I know that's not everybody. I guess I look at Jesus as the model of that. You know, he was honest with everybody. Pharisees hated him, wanted to kill him, did kill him. His own disciple betrayed him. Others denied him. I mean, he had a rocky relational relationship with people. But it was worth it to get to the Nicodemuses, the woman at the well. He was, to him, it was the moments where authenticity bears fruit, living from the inside out. So powerful, so good, so rich. And people come back saying, man, if you hadn't shared that with me, I would not have gone through this the way I did. That to me is so worth it, that the momentary light afflictions, as Paul described them in 2 Corinthians, they don't count a whole lot. Yeah, there's betrayers out there, but that they're not going to get it anyway until God does a deeper work in their heart. Is that nuts?
Yeah, but I honestly think, though,
I love watching the gears turn in your head. How do I talk to this guy? He's nuts.
No, I think there's an element in this, though, that is a unique and supernaturally imparted piece of the legacy and story and character and nature of God that you are leaving on the planet. Because you just described all of those things, and yet 2 years ago, your other half, your life partner, your life love.
This was 3 years ago.
Or 3 years ago. Yep. Sorry, 3 years ago. Was gone.
Yeah.
On your way back from a trip, you come home and is gone. And I know that it wasn't malicious. I know Sarah's heart. I know it wasn't malicious. Right. It was survival. I completely know that. Right. But you just described all these things, and yet the woman of your life partner, your other half, still...
Whose wagon is linked to mine.
Or whose wagon is is enmeshed, yes. Is collided and enmeshed.
It's like really one wagon, right?
Yes, exactly, yes. Yeah.
I get it. I was thinking about that too, as I was talking.
Somebody took a blowtorch to the wagon and cut it in half for a period of time.
Yep.
And
it hurt like crazy.
I know it did.
No, the pain was horrible, but the pain was also part of the process. Healing if we could, going on if not, in whatever way God would have in mind. But man, I cried for days and nights. You were with me through that time. You know what?
Well, I know. But that's the thing. There's a reason why the mental health professional that you were working with gave you such a small percentage of probability that there would ever be reunification.
Yep.
Not only from Sarah's side, but from yours too. The ability to genuinely keep your heart open to someone that you loved so deeply and then had that experience happen, to be able to keep your walls down and not allow the pain to activate fear and survival mode versus, and maybe that's the part of the piece of it, is your ability to hold pain without it being the thing that shuts you down. Because so many people are pain adverse, that especially looking at that type of scenario, it's like, I will never feel like that again. Whatever I need to do, however I need to cut myself off, protect myself, distance myself, whatever it might be, I will never feel that again. And that, I hear that so often.
I do too, from other people. I do.
And yet you look at their lives, and as a result of that vow that they made, that decision that they made, now all of a sudden you see with the clients that I'm working with, it's a string of incomplete or unsatisfying relationships that they're coming to me to get counseling from. But it's because they made that statement of, I will never feel that again. That pain was too much. I will never allow myself to go there again. And for you, for whatever reason, you've said, yeah, the pain is part of the process, and that's just part of the deal. There are not very many people that agree upon that.
How sad, because scripture is so full of the things that matter in life will cause pain. Mm-hmm. Lewis said, if you love deeply, you'll hurt deeply. C.S. Lewis.
Yeah.
And I think people who maybe never get the other side of that, I think part of why this worked between Sarah and I, it wasn't that she left me because she hated me. I mean, pictures were up in her apartment, for Pete's sakes, which I couldn't figure out. Yeah. She genuinely loved me. So I've been genuinely loved for 46 years. And so that's why her departure was such a shock. I mean, she filled up the freezer with my favorite foods and I mean, just all kinds of things that said, this woman really cares about me. And I think that's why of that 1%, we found our way back because there wasn't the betrayal of love. We still loved each other. There was something Sarah had to do to stay alive. And God used that in an amazing way to uncover some things in Sarah. Again, that's more about intimacy. It uncovers some things in Sarah that needed to be uncovered. That had been hidden for 64 years had been hidden. And that's to me, that those are markers on the trail that say, that's why this is worth it. Mm-hmm. If Sarah would have just followed the agenda and just me alone, my apartment, rest of my life, she would be miserable. I would think by now. I don't know what I would be. I would be miserable for a long time, but I was gonna hold out for her because I really felt like there was something and God was telling me, it's not what it appears to be. And I'll bring her back to you. So if you've got that, and there are times when I had a hard time trusting that, but when I could trust it, and then it only took like 5 weeks. So that's pretty small in terms of other people maybe waiting for someone they love that may be going to multiple months. I've got 3 or 4 people that I'm working with right now that when the mental health professional told me that you have a less than 1% chance of seeing of ever talking to Sarah again. And I went, what? And she said, that's what trauma does. Trauma destroys a marriage 99% of the time. That's documented somewhere or whatever. And I've seen the other 99%. I know that it's a rarity, but I think it's a rarity because what we had was real. One of us wasn't living in the shadow of the other. They were living in the shadow of a pain and a trauma they didn't know about. And then suddenly it went from me being alone with Jesus to me wanting you in that with me. And then things cycled. But to me, that's just another story looking back of going, God, that was so worth it. That was so worth it. And then all that God shaped in me because of, he and Sarah were having a moment down in their little apartment Camarillo. He and I were having moments up at the house and the garden and the tender garden and being tenderhearted and just all that God has moved in my life. And now through this back cancer thing, same thing. I see some of what this is about now. I do. And it's God making some adjustments in my life. It's not, don't think he provided the cancer. I don't think he did this to slow me down, anything like that. But what's come out of it is a different focus in my heart that God has taken something that darkness intended for real evil means, and he's using it for good and focusing my heart on some things and seeing some beauty in pain that I hadn't seen before. And so I think it's having the opposite effect of what the enemy intended, which is good for that. I find intimacy, I was caught with that as a young man, I think, the intimacy of what a walk with God could look like. And I don't mean to contrive thing. I had for many years expectations around what that intimacy was that was never going to happen because it was taking incidences in scripture and then making them principles and rules to follow and all that stuff. Now it's just, it is whatever it is today. He's the giver. I'm the receiver. So I'm not sitting here telling you, God, this is what you need to do. And this is how you need to go about it. It's the sentence from last time, he's doing a work in me. I'm not doing a work for him, whether that's writing or anything else I'm doing. But intimacy has been the draw to me. I've not had the terror side of intimacy. Mm-hmm. I've had relationships and jobs where intimacy was not allowed. And so did I get hurt there? Yes. Did I step away? Yes. Did I find intimacy in other relationships that were incredibly powerful? Yes, I did.
Yeah.
And even if they're temporary, even if someone's going to die or move away, I've still treasured that relationship. In this day and age, you get on the phone and call, you can talk to people in Australia or South Africa or anywhere else you want to.
That was one of the things that I deeply appreciated about the sentences that you were throwing out last week when we were talking about what is salvation, and we were kind of starting the exploration of that, and you put those words out there that you and Toby are working on.
I got some great feedback on that, by the way. We're not going to get to it today, so if you still want to feedback into that, please take advantage of it, but go ahead.
I just was thinking about the first line, and I think that's where a lot of this freedom honestly comes from, is it's God winning us over in his love. Because that's for me, that's what started this whole thing, was me sitting in a room feeling like a piece of absolute worthless junk in all my mess and my brokenness and all those things. And I felt fully seen by God in that, and yet fully loved.
Yep.
Like it was this simultaneous, like, yeah, I see it all. And that has nothing to do with my love for you. And that like was so shattering to the point where, I mean, shattered a 2.5 year episode of major depressive disorder. I mean, just astronomical, because to be seen in a multitude of imperfections and be like, yeah, so I could care less about the imperfections. I'm excited to get to unravel those for you and to get to heal those for you and to get to restore some of those for you and to bring my justice back into those things for you. That holds nothing on my love for you. And that was so earth-shattering of an experience for me, that it was like, you know, C.S. Lewis's idea of the divine collision, where no matter what happens from that point, my life will never be the same.
Yep.
There's no way for me to unknow that,
right,
to unexperience that. And that was the catalyst for where I'm at today.
And that's disruptive to the theology we grew up with, right? That God can't bear to look on sin. God's so contemptuous of our sin that if he sees anything out of order, you got to get repented under the blood, which Toby and I were working on this thing about what is salvation really good to. It's not that God, because of the cross, is blinded to our sin. It's if that's your understanding of redemption, that you've been imputed righteousness, and now you're safe with God, you still misunderstand God. Because God loves us in the midst of our brokenness, and he's willing to love us out of that brokenness, which means that's probably a lifetime adventure for him, my lifetime, not his, and he's not going to be done here, and he's not expecting to be done here. He is investing himself in the intimacy of our relationship in the places where I'm broken, depressed, and doubting. I don't have to pretend anything with God, and pretending with him only delays the good stuff.
Oh my gosh, yes. I mean, talk about a freeing relationship, right? To be fully seen of like everything. There is absolutely nothing that you have done, thought, experienced, etc., that he doesn't know, hasn't seen, and yet completely and entirely loves you in reckless abandon. Okay. Talk about something that is going to upend all of my excuses, all of my guards, my self-protections, all the things, because it's like, yeah, I see it all. I mean, that was, for me, that was the next phase of my relationship with him, that it's still in process, but that was the next kind of deep, deep revelation that was so monumental for me, was I could be completely, bluntly, unabashedly honest with him, and it didn't faze him. Didn't faze him, didn't faze his love, didn't faze our relationship. It was just like, cool, I love talking with you about this. Yeah. Oh my gosh, talking with you about this.
It's the end of the semester, Kyle.
Oh, it is. Oh my gosh, I've had 128 papers I've had to grade in the last 48 hours.
I was going to say, this is one of the quotes I really loved in the article. It said, the need for intimacy in a human life and in a human social life is as foundational as daily hunger and our never-ending thirst, and needs to be met in just the same practical way every day, just as necessarily and just as frequently in touch, in conversation, in listening, in seeing, in the back and forth of ideas and intimate exchanges that I say I am here and you are here, and that by touching our bodies, our minds, our shared work in the world, we make a world together. That's the world I want to be a part of, a world that's filled with that kind of intimacy, that we drink of it as daily as I drink of water or Diet Coke or eat a lunch or dinner in the evening, that's as much a need in our humanity. And if anxiety is causing us to starve that need, what are we doing? What are we doing to our culture? What are we doing to ourselves? When I deny myself, because of my anxiety, I deny myself the opportunity for intimacy. Or because I've been hurt before and I'm going to make sure I never get hurt again, so I'm going to protect against that. It's easier to protect yourself by just saying, hey, toxic people, take some distance. That fixes it too, right? It's not, I'm going to close me off to anybody else now because I met a toxic person who tried to eat me up with their demands on my life and took advantage of my honesty for their gain. That doesn't change you. That only changes them. And I love seeing that intimacy. That's how way I've lived it my whole life. And the first was intimacy with God. That's the intimacy I wanted more than anything. And God touched that at a young age. God didn't really fulfill that in me till probably in my mid-40s when I began to feel like, okay, I'm gaining some traction in this intimacy with God. And part of that is I've let go of my expectations and my demands and my human performance to make it happen, whether it's trying to be sinless or trying to do great stuff for God. Ending all that, finding him in the midst of my just broken honesty, the intimate father I'd always wanted. And then finding relationships of others who know him and can share that. And even people in the world who don't know him yet, but they can be entrusted with a part of what's going on inside of me. And it opens doors for them to circle back. I don't have time for this. I want to talk about the vision at some point, and we don't have time today, but I shared this vision thing I was having with my ophthalmologist. I had a recently appointment with her, and I said, I want to tell you something that's been going on in my, and she goes, what? And I said, I see color, and I see these things. She said, well, it's very normal. People close their eyes, see color. That's very normal. I said, okay. What if they're like people and shapes and things and actual things you're seeing? And she goes, you're hallucinating. I might be. And if I am, I told Sarah when this started, this could either be a God thing or I'll be in a mental hospital in a year. Well, it's been a year and I'm not in the mental hospital yet. So that's a positive. And she just said, do you know the difference between what's real and not real when you're having these, when you know what's part of the real world and what's part of what's going on inside your vision? And I said, yeah, oh, always. She said, well, then you're fine. But then she turned around and she was wanting to ask more. I think she was wanting to go like, what are you seeing or whatever? She seemed to be interested, yeah. But she looked at her watch and realized, I don't have time to get into this. So we were done with our appointment. But just enough to kind of, I want to know if I'm nuts, first of all. I really wanted an honest view of what I'm, is it possible to see what I'm seeing from a human thing? And she said, yeah, if you're hallucinating, you can. And I said, well, my faith makes room for a vision thing too. And she goes, oh, okay. And that's where we ended. So I'm crazy.
But I love those opportunities to be able to just share a piece of what God is up to in our lives in that regard. I think that's where that vulnerability, especially when it doesn't matter, like whatever their opinion is of our journey and our faith with God doesn't matter. That's when it gets really interesting. Because that I got an email from a student, and one of the homework assignments that I gave to my students, it resulted in a reconciliation with a child that had been almost 3 years in the making.
Wow.
And it was because of the homework assignment and because of some of the dialogue that occurred as a result of it. And they just took the time to email me back and say, hey, just wanted to let you know this was the result of one of your homework assignments. And it's like, what? Like, I mean, I always try to create them my homework and stuff to be very relational, very experiential, but to even get that feedback of like, this is me being who God is or who God's created me to be. And as a result, even a simple homework assignment could be the catalyst for a parent and a child to come together after 3 years cool. of pretty significant relational disconnect.
So intimacy is the greatest hunger we have. And anxiety is the thing that keeps us from knowing that hunger.
Yes.
It'd be worth really exploring that Matthew 6 where Jesus says, be anxious for nothing. Mm. Relax. Let the Father give you. Don't try to get. And I would hope people would, listening to this, if you want the kind of intimacy that's authentic and real, then find a way with God's help, because you'll never do it on your own, past your anxiety into those. And you definitely want to start with safe relationships. You want to start with relationships people are going to handle it. And people will love you in spite of the brokenness in your life and the things you're going through, because they're honest about their brokenness. That's what opened the door to that. But if you can jump over your anxiety and find your way into intimacy, my goodness, a great future awaits for sure.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.